Okay, today's reading is on page 1217 of your Bibles. Come now, ye who say, today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, ye boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you, and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold the wages of the labourers who have mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered a righteous person. He does not resist you. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or earth, or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes, and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation.
Thank you, Mark. Keep your Bible open there on page 1217. We're carrying on in this series looking at this part of the Bible, which I've certainly found very, very challenging myself. Very challenging indeed, and I hope that we all have, actually. If we've not found it challenging, then we've not been hearing it right. It's one of the parts of the Bible that I think really does get under the skin of regular churchgoers. We've listened in to various things that have been going on in the church 2,000 years ago as we read this letter together. We've kind of like overheard a church that is pretty good at grumbling. We've kind of listened in and we've overheard discontentments that are going around in a church. We've overheard and we've kind of listened in to quarrels that there have been. We've heard about divisions. We've heard about favouritism. We've heard about gossip. And we've heard about judgmentalism. And in one sense, it's all very encouraging to realise that we're not alone. The church these days is always being slammed, isn't it, for being judgmentalist and for gossip and favouritism hits churches. And churches down the centuries are always hit by grumblings. And it's kind of like nice to know that we're not alone. In actual fact, much of the New Testament, much of the second part of our Bible was written because churches were going wrong and needed to be put right. So it's good in some ways, but look at chapter 3 and verse 10. It says, these things ought not to be so. Now, they shouldn't be there. So when the church gets hammered in the Sunday newspapers because of hypocrisy, etc., the newspapers are right. It shouldn't be so in the church of God, but often it is. Now, if I asked everyone here, the themes of wealth and poverty have been there in the letter, they carry on this evening, and I think some of the judgmentalism that's been going on, some of the favouritism that's been going on there in the letter with the first readers, I think it arose out of the differences actually in where people stood with wealth and poverty. I think that was a basis of a judgmental attitude and favouritism that there was. And wealth and poverty continues in the section that Mark just read for us. this evening. If I asked everyone here who thought that they were rich to raise their hands, I'm not going to ask you to do that, and some of you are real keen to get your hands up there. I guess that some of you would perhaps put your hands up. If I then switched it and said, look, please raise your hand if you think you're poor, then probably a fewer people would raise their hands, but perhaps one or two people here this evening might raise their hands and say, I'm poor. I guess the majority of us, though, wouldn't raise our hands at all. Some of that, I don't doubt, is because we're shy and we're British, and that's just not the sort of thing that you do. You certainly don't come to church service on Sunday for the guy at the front to ask you to raise your hand whether to admit whether you think you're rich or poor. So yes, there is the shyness factor and the cultural factor going on there. But I guess that part of it is because all of this, wealth is something which you only measure it in comparative terms, don't you? Wealth is by, I only know how wealthy I am when I compare myself to Chris. I only know how poor I am in comparison to someone who lives in Ranmore or Fulwood or wherever else in Sheffield. Crooks, someone said. Who lives in Crooks? Walkley? It's a comparative thing, and we can all think of someone richer than us. So if you asked, are you rich? Well, you think, well, actually, compared to so-and-so, I'm not actually rich. So you kind of think, well, you keep your hands down. And if asked if you're poor, well, generally you'll know someone poor even if you're a student and you don't live in Walkley or somewhere else. You'll think, well, actually, there are people poorer than me, so I wouldn't actually put myself in that bracket either. Which generally we are, I suppose, in-betweeners, although that's not really a word, is it? We're kind of not really rich, not really poor, we're kind of in-between. Which means, of course, that there's guaranteed to be someone in Sheffield who thinks that you're fabulously rich. On the whole, generally, I reckon that we are, as a congregation, we are very rich in compared to some people who live in the city of Sheffield. We are very rich compared to some folks that live in Rotherham and Barnsley. And other parts of South Yorkshire. We are incredibly rich when you compare us to people who live in Africa, for example. We are stunningly rich, fabulously wealthy. There's some challenges, I think, for us from the Bible tonight that the rich are targeted. Look at verse 13 of chapter 4. It says this: come now, you who say today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. And look at chapter 5 and verse 1: come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. So the rich are targeted, so let's get ready for that and get our kind of, I suppose, for want of a better phrase, our spiritual antenna in tune. Say, okay, I'm going to tune into this and I want to receive it right. But of course, it's not just the rich that are challenged, targeted in the passage this evening. The poor are as well. And it seems that perhaps the poor, like I said, are suffering at the hands of the rich. And they are called to be godly in the midst of their suffering. So look again on chapter 5 and verse 7. It says, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. Well, who is he talking to? Who is he saying, be patient to? Well, it says there, verse 10, as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. So there's some folks there who seem to be poorer people who are warned, challenged, encouraged to be patient in the midst of their suffering. So the rich and the poor are both targeted by God, by his word this evening. So first of all, the warning to the rich. Warning the rich. And quite simply, the first kind of point that I want to draw out in terms of the warning to the rich is this: don't trust your wealth, but trust God. Don't trust your wealth, trust God. And that's chapter 4 and verses 13 through to 17. Wealth leads to all sorts of freedoms. We're hearing earlier on from Dave about James Bond and independence being one of the crucial things that James Bond has. And in Casino Royale, he's got a heck of a lot of money at his personal disposal in that film. And there's something about the James Bond character is he always seems to have shed loads of money. Money, wealth, buys freedom. It does buy independence. And it's so often easy for us, who are wealthy, to take some of those freedoms that wealth buys us for granted. To just not notice what we've got. For example, travel. You simply jump in the car, or catch a bus, or a train, or a plane, and off we go. Back in March, Dave and myself and two others went to New York, and we went to visit a church called Redeemer Church in New York, to learn that they started in Manhattan about 18 years ago, similar to us in the sense there were 50 youngish people started our church. And 50 or so folks started this church in the middle of Manhattan. There's their story and our story. There's all sorts of little links, actually, and the story is fascinating to read. I can say, well, hang on, that's a similar thing happened to us. But when we flew to New York, we arrived at Manchester Airport, and the whole of the eastern seaboard of America was frozen solid. It had snowed very, very heavily indeed. So we arrived there, we'd stayed at Dave's mum and dad's house not far from Manchester Airport, and we got up at 5 in the morning, we got to the airport at about 5:45 to find that there was nothing moving from New York or anywhere on the eastern seaboard of the USA. So that was it. We were ever so disappointed. It had taken ages to set up all these meetings with all these people. It wasn't just the one church we were visiting, all these other people in New York. But goodness me, I mean, all this planned for a while. They had a great thick manual on church planting, which we'd read, well, most of us had. We were going to work our way through it, had all our questions, it was all frozen solid, couldn't get there. Well, we went back to Dave's mum and dad's house, and Dave's dad answered the door, having given us a lift, and he's dressing down. He'd gone back to bed again. He welcomed us in, and we sat there and had a cup of tea and a cup of coffee, and we put on the computer, and we started looking at all the forecasts and all the information, and then lastminute.com to see what was going, and we very soon discovered that the airports were beginning to open, and we managed to find a different airline flying from Heathrow Airport down in London later in the evening on the same Saturday. We were in a Ford car, Pete Jackson, big lad, Matt Thompson, big lad, Dave Cross, long lad, me. We shot down the motorway in a Ford car, we got to America in the same day. And we were amazed. We were talking and laughing and saying, it's amazing, you can do, but when you put your mind to it, you can go anywhere on the planet within 24 hours. The fact is, Dave's dad had a nice credit card. It was money that made that possible. It was money that made it possible. It was free. We bought us the freedom to get there and not miss the trip. Wealth makes travel simple. And the wealthy seem to have taken this for granted in James's day. Verse 13 of chapter 4. Come now, you who say today, tomorrow, we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. They had their mission, their vision, their value statements. No doubt they developed their annual and 10-year goals to achieve them. They made their detailed plans. But they forgot one important thing. Ultimately, it's not what we plan that happens. It's what God plans that happens. He's God, not us. And we shouldn't ever forget that. The rich, and we've got to include ourselves, most of us here in that tonight. We've got to get our thinking straight, haven't we? Our attitudes have got to be shaped by the bigger picture. Our lives are like mist. The sun comes up, warms up the day, and burns the mist, and the mist burns off and it disappears. That's exactly what our lives are like. Here today, potentially gone tomorrow. Freud defined life as this. It's somewhat morbid. He defined life as the beginning of death. That's a very nice thought, isn't it? Meditate on that for a while. Life, the beginning of death. You see yourself becoming very, very sad and depressed. But the thrust is the same there in verse 14, isn't it, of our passage. One day you won't be here and nor will I. And the world will go on without us. Not many people will notice. And if we've got a wonderful, doesn't matter how fabulous our gravestone is, after a while, not many people will even notice our gravestone. That'll be it. Like the mist. Verse 14 says exactly that to those that think they can go around the world trading and doing their business, and I've got the money to pay to get there and do a bit of business and get some profit. Well, verse 14, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Gone. And you wouldn't even know it had been there. And we must have that in our mindset. Those of us who are wealthy, our consciences must also be infused with the statement that follows in verse 15, if the Lord wills, we will do this. And it's not saying don't plan. It's not saying live for today, plan tomorrow, a party tonight. No, it's that's a poster I had on my wall when I was an undergraduate, Pink Panther, throwing a dart, a paper aeroplane there. But we must plan. We just got to get our thinking right and say, well, I may not be here tomorrow. And so if the Lord wills, we'll do this, we'll do that, we'll do the other. I must trust him, not my wealth. I must trust God, not me. Since what happens is primarily up to the Lord, not us, not me, there's no reason to brag or to boast about our wealth. We do have a tendency, don't we, to boast. It's kind of very, very cultural, isn't it, to brag about what we've got. I'm about to give a massive sweeping generalisation here, but it's only to make the point. So if it doesn't fit you, then allow it to spread over you. But generalise, women tend to boast about bargain clothes, I guess, and men tend to boast about bargain cars. What does verse 16 say to us? As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is what? What does the verse say? This is evil. It's kind of like, I did it. But no, it's God that's given it ultimately, isn't it? His will. Not ours. Since our wealth comes from God, then we must do it, use it for good. Not using it for the right, is rebellious, it's sinful. Verse 17, so whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is a sin. So no boasting, do the right thing with what God has given to us. James's first readers may not have gone out of their way to be malicious to the poor. They may simply have just been ignorant of what real poverty was like. And as a result, they didn't even notice the poor man's needs or how their wealth or possessions may help the poorer person. And so let's move to the second warning to the rich. The second warning to the rich is don't use your wealth to oppress the poor. And that's chapter 5 and verses 1 to 6. This seems to have been happening in a number of ways. And I guess that it seems to have been happening through what we might call the sin of negligence, rather than actually taking the initiative to do something bad to somebody, just kind of like ignoring somebody and just getting on with your life, and so not using your wealth for good. Hoarding, that seems to be the first thing there in verses 1 to 3. They were hoarding their possessions. Their possessions bore all the marks of disuse. Their wardrobes full of clothes they didn't wear very often. I don't know, we talk about collections, don't we? I've got a collection of whatever it happens to be. And I don't know if having a collection of whatever it happens to be is kind of, I don't know, where is it? It could possibly just be an excuse or a nice word for hoarding. Is it a nice middle class way of, I'm a hoarder in this particular area. got a collection. I don't know, you judge that. That's just some thoughts that have been going through my mind as I pondered that. Hoarding, verses 1 and 3. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you, and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Hoarding, defrauding seems to have been going on. Rich landowners seem to have been holding back on paying their workers. Again, they may not have wanted to go out of their way to cause so much stress and anguish, but for, you know, to a rich person, a few quid is a few quid, but to a poor person, a few quid is a few meals. Just when you're rich, you don't see that. You know, big companies can hold back on paying smaller companies. And it puts the squeeze on. The big company doesn't really know what kind of squeeze they're putting on as the smaller supplier. Verse 4 says, behold, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvest have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. Well, hoarding, defrauding, indulging. Well, money buys success, doesn't it? Independence, those two James Bond characteristics that Dave took us to earlier on. Success and independence does lead to self-indulgence, doesn't it? If we're not careful. The rich use their wealth for extravagant comfort, it seems. Comfort is not... God doesn't disallow comfort at all. You read great portions of the Bible, you've got some fabulously wealthy people like Solomon in the Old Testament. But when folks become Christians, when we come to understand God's extraordinary generosity towards us, the way the Bible puts it, that he was rich beyond compare, Jesus Christ, in heaven, with all the glory of heaven. You know, the Revelation, the last book of the Bible, talks about heaven, but like streets paved with gold. That's the kind of imagery that he uses. Fabulous wealth, had it all, gave it all up to become extremely poor, born in a shed, born with like cow muck and all the rest of it, and came and lived the life of a servant, and came to die in our place and go through the separation from his father. My God, why have you forsaken? Well, I've forsaken you for Tim. That through your poverty he might become rich and have eternity that he doesn't deserve. Because he should deserve my judgment. He does. When we come to understand that, we don't want to use our wealth for self-indulgence. We want to bring it, the focus of our wealth being so often is that it's me, bring it into me for my benefit. No. When you understand what God is like, and you want to actually give it out. Not for self-indulgence. Verse 5 says, you have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. Just getting fatter and fatter. Self-indulgence. It just shouldn't fit with the Christian mindset when you come to understand God and the good news of Jesus. Helmut Tillich was a German pastor who stood against Adolf Hitler and against Nazism. I think the history books talk about he was a signatory of a bunch of Christian leaders who were opposed to Adolf Hitler, the secret police managed to get a hold of this list, the kind of like handwritten minutes of a meeting of this group of people, down the list they arrested absolutely everybody, and most of them went to their deaths. But they couldn't read the last person's name on the list. It's Helmut Tillich. He survived. And he famously said that our checkbooks have more to do with heaven and hell than our hymn books. I don't know if you've ever heard that, but it was that guy who stood against Hitler who said that. Our checkbooks have more to do with heaven and hell than our hymn books. Now that's only what you really believe in your heart. So there's hoarding, defrauding, indulging, murdering. I don't know what seems to have been going on. Paul, last week, just talking about the murderous attitudes that seems to have been there in James writing this letter. When you read Jesus says, you hate your brother. It's as bad as murdering him. Murder begins in the heart. I think there may be a little bit of a sense of that coming through in verse 6. What we do know is that wealth then, as is now, is still a motive for murder in reality, isn't it? People will kill for money. They do. It's a dangerous thing, isn't it? You have condemned, you have murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. And so the warning, serious warnings to the rich. The rich are warned against false confidence, arrogance that wealth brings. We are warned to see the power that wealth brings to oppress people, to oppress others, just by ignoring their needs. And God will judge those who oppress the poor. Look at the second half of verse 1, 3, 4 and 5. Verse 1, the second half there, talks about miseries that are coming upon you. And verse 3, you have laid up treasure in the last days. And verse 4 says, the cries of the harvest have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. And it's verse 5, you have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. It's talking about the end days and the final day of judgment. See, hoarding, defrauding, selfish indulgence will be judged by God. So they are serious warnings for us to heed and just to, you know, reflect upon and think upon in our own consciences. Those of us just reflect back to our trip to New York. We went to this church, Redeemer Church, and a number of years ago they started this organisation called Hope for New York. Hope for New York. And Hope for New York is an outfit which, its slogan is helping people help people. And what they aim to do is to get as many members of the church serving or linked to some Christian organisation that is working amongst poor and marginalised people in New York. They have over 3,000 members of the church on their books, does Hope for New York, and sends people out, doctors, to work amongst HIV patients. It sends folks out on our former big yellow buses that used to be school buses to give advice to citizens, advice that we have in this country. It's not so freely available in parts of New York. People can go for advice. They need financial help. You turn up to the yellow bus where there'll be some people who are professionals who are there who can give advice and help to you. So Hope for New York, I found that tremendously challenging. But, you know, one of the key things that is behind the vision that they have for Hope for New York isn't simply helping poor people. One of the main aims, and they're unashamed about this, is to get rich people alongside to get to know a poor person, a marginalised person, a refugee, someone with HIV, so that the rich Christian understands what it's like, because it'll be good for them to understand what it's like. They'll be less self-indulgent, perhaps more generous as they reflect upon poverty and in the light of the gospel. I found that very, very challenging indeed, and my mind has been going around that for some time now. Perhaps that's something that you can kind of begin to think about yourself over the coming days. Warning to the rich, warning to the poor, second main heading. And the first warning here is, don't grumble, be patient. Verses 7 to 9 of chapter 5. It'd be so easy for poor in the stresses and the pain of their circumstances to grumble, fight for justice, to covet what the rich have. And it seems to me that some of their grievances would be justified. But the Bible warns that, the Bible on a number of occasions actually warns against grumbling. The Israelites, as they came out of the desert, they were saved from slavery in Egypt way back in the Old Testament. And God had rescued them and they find themselves in the desert. What do? They grumble. And God gets really uptight about that, and it's understandable that he does. God is against grumbling. Grumbling of the poor, in one sense, is as bad as the discrimination and the hoarding of the rich. Grumbling is kind of, in one sense, it's kind of like saying, well, God, you're not doing a good enough job. or I'm not getting enough from you. If I was you, I'd do it differently. It kind of grumbling borders on, I want to be God. It's a dangerous game to play as the grumbling one. Grumbling will be judged. Now the poor are called to be patient until the coming of the Lord, when all wrongs will be put right. And that's verses 7 to 9. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. And you also be patient, establish your hearts. So it's quite a powerful and a strong little phrase there. Establish your hearts. You know, take action to remain firm. For the coming of the Lord is at hand. Be patient, establish your heart, the way you think, your attitudes, stay stable. Verse 9, do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. So don't grumble. Like I said, grumbling in one sense gets close to playing at being God. Grumbling is a great principle, is it doesn't just apply to wealth and poverty. I don't know, you might be sat here this evening feeling a bit hard done by in life. We go through stages. How do you tonight feel hard done by? So easy, isn't it, to grumble about it. The Lord knows. And there will come a day when all wrongs will be put right. And if we instinctively go for the grumbling, we're kind of saying, well, I don't believe that. I don't trust a day when Jesus... I don't trust God's fair and he'll put all wrongs to right. I'd rather grumble now and try and get a bit of satisfaction now. But do we believe in Jesus in the second coming? It's a warning there, isn't it? Now the second warning to the poor is there, don't give up but trust God. Verses 10 through to 12. One of the most natural responses to suffering is, this shouldn't be happening to me. Why me? The Bible actually does tell Christians to expect suffering. And if you're interested in choir this evening, and you're just pondering your mind, or just thinking about Christian things, the Bible keeps on saying to someone who's an interested inquirer, count the cost. It will lead to suffering. There are folks in this room who've become Christians who get slagged off. People will make jokes of them, and they might think it's funny, but after a while it gets wearing and hurtful. And that's there are other folks who from different parts of the world where the suffering could be somewhat more intense. And Christians are called to expect suffering and to endure it with patience, with their eyes again fixed on God and on his promises. Just as the prophets did, the folks in the Old Testament who spoke for God, many of them died, many of them were persecuted, but they remained patient and faithful with their eyes fixed on God, which is what verse 10 says. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. They trusted God. One of the greatest examples throughout the Bible is a guy called Job. He's about halfway through the Bible, through a book, the Book of Psalms, the Bible's song book, poetry book. Just before that, you've got the story of a guy called Job. And Job suffered materially, he suffered financially, he suffered physically, he suffered mentally, he suffered relationally, he suffered spiritually. He suffered an awful lot. And his friends just were no help at all. So we get the phrase Job's comforters from. His wife was no help either. And amidst the fiercest heat of the suffering, Job says this. In fact, turn to it. I was going to just read it out to you, but turn to it. Then, if you're interested to know where Job is, you can find it now. Page 514. Job chapter 19 and verse 25. In the midst of the storm of his own suffering, he says these words, and it's not stiff upper lip. It's not kind of like, you know, I'm British before the British arrived, and I've got resilience and perseverance. It's actually patience, and he has the foresight to see who God is. God is marked by grace, and God won't always just be out there in the unknown, like wind the clock up and just leave the universe to go. No, he saw a day when God would actually come to this earth, would have his feet in the streets. Job believed that. As we said there in verse 25, in the midst of horrendous suffering, he said, for I know that my Redeemer lives, And at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me. His heart faints. But he looks to the day when he will actually meet the living God. God is gracious. Gracious to Job. And come back to James, the book of James, in verse 11. Behold, we consider, chapter 5, those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job? Well, you just have. We've all heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Ultimately, Job looked towards Jesus, who I've already described as the one who left the riches of heaven and came and suffered for you and for me. God is gracious and wonderfully compassionate to each and every one of us. So in the heat of the moment, sometimes it's easy, isn't it? As we've been thinking about earlier in the series, Matt talking about the use of the tongue the tongue leaps into gear often before our brains, and sometimes nowadays it's not just our tongues, it's email. You know, we bang off the email. I was talking with some folks on Thursday, and one was just sharing how, you know, someone had really made him edgy and uptight at work, and he found himself angry 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, writing out the email. And then he reread it and think, no, I shouldn't send an email like this while I'm angry, and I shouldn't send it at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm probably not thinking straight. He reads through it again, and now he just hits the send button in the end. And as he's done it, he knows, and he's copied all the various other managers and directors in the company. He knows he's done the right, and he can't get it back. Now, the control of the tongue is a sign of the person who has faith in the living God, who will put all wrongs to right. The lack of control of the tongue, it sort of shows where the heart is. Actually, I don't trust God. I'd rather try and sort it out myself. And I think that's really where verse 12 is picking up. It's the steady nerve, the steady tongue. It trusts God. But above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth, or by any other oath. Just talk simple, let your yes be yes, and your no be no. Be in control. You trust God, so that you may not fall under condemnation, because the judge is standing at the door. Well, James, the Bible is not against wealth and pleasure. And the example of Job fits with that. If you read the whole story of Job, you find he lost everything, but at the end of the story, he ends up with even more, fabulously wealthy. Wealth is a part of God's good gift to the world. Money is not the root of all evil. Money can be a rich blessing to people. The love of money, the Bible says, is the root of all kinds of evil. The love of money leads to arrogance. The love of money leads to hoarding. The love of money leads to indulgence and fraud and murder. The love of money, that's for the rich. The love of money for the poor leads to grumbling and jealousy and discontentment. Now, the love of the money is the problem. Money itself isn't. Wealth isn't. It can be a fabulous, wonderful gift of God if used in the way that he would use it. As most of us here are neither really rich or really poor, I guess the teaching of the poor and the rich will be relevant at different times and different ways to each of us here tonight. We should enjoy what God gives us, the benefits we gain, but we must also be generous with what God gives to us. And we should be other people centred, not self-centred. And James puts all the teaching on money in the context of the final day, the big picture. And he urges us to see our wealth, our poverty, in the light of the end of the world and God coming to judge. And we must have that same view ourselves. I'll end with another quote. Hudson Taylor, who was a British man, missionary, went to China to tell folks in China about the Lord Jesus Christ. And Hudson Taylor wrote this in his diary on one occasion, and I'll leave there. We come to a moment of prayer in just a moment, but this, I think, it's just a great little quote. It's one illustration, but I hope it'll kind of get your mind thinking, well, actually, how does this begin to change me? Hudson Taylor wrote this: heard a sermon last night on the second coming, went home and greatly thinned out my wardrobe. Isn't that great? heard a sermon on the second coming, went home and greatly thinned out my wardrobe. Been reading in James, haven't we, that we understand who God is, we hear him, it doesn't just stay here or in our hearts, it leads to change.